evaluations.
Close the four chapters. And the number of events are related. The first chapter deals with what has been called Mechiras Yosef, the struggle, the strife between Yosef and his brethren, and then the sale that took place. The second chapter, which is chapter 38, deals with the incident, the event that took place as a result of the Mechiras Yosef with Yehuda and Tamar. The third chapter is Perek Lamed Tes, which speaks about Yosef and his sojourn in Egypt, the beginning, and the relationship of Yosef and his master and the incident with his master's wife. And that's placed next to the chapter of Yehuda and Tamar. The fourth chapter, the final chapter, deals with the dreams of the Sar HaMashkim and the Sar HaOfim, the chief butler and the chief baker, and they're being placed in the prison in what Yosef had found himself at that time. So these are four chapters dealing with the Mechiras Yosef and Yosef's period in Egypt. Now the Parsha Lamed Zayin begins that Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Megurei Aviv Be'eretz Knoan, that Yaakov dwelt in the land of Megurei Aviv, Be'eretz Canaan. So the famous Chazal, the rabbis make a point immediately by saying that Bikesh Yaakov Leishev B'Shalva. Yaakov sought to sit in peace. And the way Hirsch describes it, he hoped to settle down quietly after his long wanderings. And Kofetz Olov Rugzei Shel Yosef. So the roges of Yosef, the anger and the scorn that that Yosef's relationship brought about between him and his brethren, so this brought about a very depressing situation for Yaakov Avinu. He was already an older person. He thought he had made his contribution. Like we discussed in great detail in the last few chapters, that the period of Yaakov's being by Lavan was, in a sense, a precursor to the part of the Golus that Jews will have to go through. And Yaakov thought that he had lived through this period. The Bris of Yaakov, the covenant with Yaakov, has taken place. And we mentioned a few weeks ago that the idea was, not really, that was still in the same mode of the Bris pattern of living of his father Yitzchak. The real tsaris that Yaakov was supposed to undergo, and again, which would be the prelude to the tsaris that the children, his descendants, would undergo, and that brought about in a later chapter when Hashem tells him, don't be afraid, I am going down with you. If you recall, we spoke in detail about that, that although you will be oppressed and you will be persecuted, and physically and subjected to the worst types of punishments, yet you have nothing to fear because I am with you. This still awaited this older man, Yaakov, at this point. He thought that he had now, the time had come to relax. Now, what does a Yaakov Avinu want to relax for? Obviously, he doesn't want to relax because he wants to, you know, to sit down and play cards or go to the races. I mean, obviously, what does Yaakov Avinu want to relax? He wants to relax so he could be an Eved Hashem, that he could serve God, that he could study Torah in peace and tranquility. So then the question comes up, so what's the problem with Algut? I mean, it's not that he wants to waste his time. What's wrong with having to sit b'shalva and to be an Oved Hashem? If he has a beautiful house, and if he has all his needs taken care of, and only has nachas, then he could serve God. I mean, is there anything wrong with that? Yet it seems that the Chazal condemn Yaakov for this to such a degree that Kofetz Olov Rugzei Shel Yosef. So this is discussed amongst all of the Bali Musar. In fact, they all ask the same question. And they say that it depends for which individual we're speaking about. If you're speaking a person of Yaakov's caliber, then the fact, and we can appreciate this even more so, then the fact that he was Leishev B'Shalva, was considered to be a deficiency or a deficiency in his character, in the character of Yaakov. Now, let's just pick one of the references that they make towards this point, and then we'll give some of our own thoughts. It says, Ve'ahavta es Hashem elekecha b'chol me'edecha, chol levavcha, chol nafshecha, v'chol me'edecha. That a person should love God, his soul, his spirit, u'v'chol me'edecha, as it's commonly interpreted, is with all his possessions, owed from all his wealth. But the Chazal also interpreted b'chol me'edecha, b'chol mido, mido, whatever measure he gives you. So they say that the first assumption is we have to understand that a person who, let's take a look at it the way he says, a person who wants to have more food, an easier time and sustenance and living and so on, so he could learn. Why can't he do the same idea now? He's suffering, perhaps. He's sleeping on the ground, all right? So does it make a difference to Yaakov Avinu if he's sleeping on a bed with a very good mattress, or if he's sleeping on the ground and he puts a stone underneath his head? He still saw the Sulam Mutzav Artzav V'Reisha Magia Shemaima. He's still sleeping on the floor with a stone under his head. He still was able to grasp the highest secrets of heaven, perhaps. So what is going to get more? What is going to get more if he has the pleasures of this world? You can't say that the purpose is, because to serve God, he's going to be able to serve God in a greater degree if he puts more emphasis on his material welfare. A person of Yaakov Avinu has already reached the Madrega, the level, and he has shown that he could serve God even if he has material problems and supposedly obstacles in his way. But by him serving God, that is not a necessary prerequisite. So therefore, the idea that Yaakov wondered to be leishiv b'shalva, he wondered to go ahead and to sit in peace, it shows a certain desire, we'll say, that Yaakov had for his physical pleasure, because it wasn't a necessary ingredient for Yaakov Avinu to serve and to reach the highest level of spirituality. He had done that in the past, and therefore, what value does this have of leishev b'shalva, of having more of a material basis? It doesn't come in any way to his service of God. It's not supposed to detract or defect in any way from his allegiance and subservience and his desire to ascend the spiritual ladder. It shouldn't, and it doesn't. Now, this was the interpretation that he gave. This was necessary for Yaakov Avinu. It says, Leidai lohem letzadikim. Isn't it enough for tzadikim that they have Edom Abba? They also want to have Leishiv B'Shalva. They should realize that this world has nothing to do in giving pleasure. In fact, they point out that there is no such thing as having pleasure in this world. This world was created in order to place obstacles in our path and to see how we develop and how we ascend. And really, we say, Anu amelim umekavlim sochar. We always say, we work and we get schar. Heim amelim v'ein umekavlim sochar. They suffer and they don't get schar. Or like the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, in this world you're going to suffer. Blessed is the one who chooses the suffering and deprivation in Torah and in spiritual points. Because otherwise the suffering is for naught. The suffering is futile. You don't receive any benefit for the suffering. Whereas if you use the suffering as a means of developing spiritually, so then you've accomplished the purpose in this world to its greatest degree. So now, under such a philosophical outlook in life, which it's difficult for us to realize it, to feel it, because by us, the Gashmiyah still has a place. But a Yaakov Avinu, for him, it's considered to be alien, even for him to have such a subconscious thought, as if Shalva really means anything. Because the purpose of this world is only to go ahead and to be Oved Hashem. Now, we once mentioned the classic expression, even from a Chofetz Chaim of our generation, we're not talking about a Yaakov Avinu, when he walked into one of his grandchildren, I think it was, and they had a carpet on the floor, or on the windows, they had a curtain, So he said he didn't want to walk in to step on the floor. Why? He says, because if I step on the floor, he says, I'm stepping on pages of the Gemara. So they didn't know what he meant. What did he mean? So the Chafetz Chaim said, because the effort and the labor that went in to earn money to be able to purchase this carpet, he said, was taken away from the study of Torah. So therefore, by walking in and stepping on this carpet, I'm stepping on Gemara. It's interesting of this approach, how it totally imbued the Chafetz Chaim and enveloped him, because he has a letter people don't realize about smoking. The Chafetz Chaim had written a document about smoking, a letter, and it's printed, it's in his books of writings. We have it upstairs. So the Chafetz Chaim analyzes the problems of smoking. So in his tamimusdika way, in his simple way, he says, first of all, it's not healthy, you know, even to what degree they understood of health. And then he said, in addition to that, he says, you're taking money and you're just burning it. Really, when you're dealing, especially now, we can appreciate that. What does it cost, $2 a pack or something? So you're just like burning money. Thirdly, he says, the time wasted in getting a cigarette and lighting a cigarette and doing all of that, he says, you could have been learning Gemara better. You could have accomplished so much in learning. So you see this concept of accomplishing so much in learning and wasting a second because it's not used for the spiritual purpose in life. So imbued him, I mean, he was so totally enveloped by that when he's dealing with a moment of lighting a match and getting a cigarette, how he looked at it. And therefore, kovet to love rugza shel Yosef. But then if we go with our premise that Yaakov Avinu had to depict the Jew in Golis, if the Jew in Golis is always going to think that if I have this, then I'll be able to learn, and if I have that, then I'll be able to learn. That's the Yetzer Hara's work, because you'll never have this, and you'll never have that, and you'll always be missing something else. So you have to have the outlook that everything, b'chol mido umido, like the Chazal say, shemode loch, whatever your lot in life will be, you have to be able to adapt to that and realize that that is no exception. Like the Talmud says, you're not different than Hillel. If you're not different than this one, if you were poor, you're not poorer than him. If you are wealthy and you're busy with your food, you're not wealthier than him. And when you look at it, who is the perfect person that has nothing to worry about and he's therefore able to sit and learn? If he's wealthy, if he's poor, so obviously, if he's wealthy, he has a lot of different problems. He has to stay on top of his financial material situation. So if a person is trying to find the utopian situation in order for him to use this life as it's supposed to be, to be Eved Hashem, there is no such thing. Therefore, the concept is, b'chol mido umido shehu modelach, in every measure that God allots to you. And Yaakov Avinu, being the one of going into Golis, like we said, he should have been the one representing that. So therefore, we say that Yaakov Avinu was strongly punished for this reason.
It seems that Yaakov, after returning to his father's home, his trials were first to begin. Up to then, it was called Tovos Yitzchak. He was just part of Yitzchak. But the house of, and he was involved in establishing his house. And when he came back to his father's home, Vishafti B'Sholem Abeis Ovi, like we learned in last week's Sedrit, he had established a Jewish house. Now that he had this Jewish house, he had to go into Golis with the Jewish house. It's like saying that there were two aspects. Yaakov represented Golis. There's the aspect of establishing a Jewish home in Golis, and then there's an aspect, after you have established the Jewish home in Golis, of existing in Golis with a Jewish home. Sometimes it's easy to establish a Jewish home, but then when you have children and grandchildren to exist in Golis with a Jewish home, that is almost impossible, one would think. And as we see, to our great sorrow. So, Bikish Yaakov Leisha B'Shavah, so they told him the time hasn't come yet. Because if you're still in this world, you have something to accomplish. You're still a gear. The moment to return to Eretz Yisrael that you have come back with salvation has already occurred, that is far off in the future. And Hirsch says, more or less, I'm expanding on his thought, but he says that Yaakov sought to sit the Eretz Migurei Aviv in the land where his fathers considered themselves as gerim. He thought that he already had become established. And we said, no, the Geirus is yet to begin.
Now we come to another point, the brothers of Yaakov.
The first thing is we have to realize that they weren't the status Or like Kurt says, how could it possibly be just, let me just read his introduction. It says, following the precedent of Smyrna, we think it is our duty to look, if not for a justification, still for an explanation for the event which now follows. After all, we have not to do with a band of robbers and murderers who would likely commit murder for the sake of a coat. Smyrna rightly points out how later on, when in their direst need, their consciences smote them, they reproached themselves in no wise over a crime committed, but only for their hard-heartedness in being able to withstand his pleading and begging, like I mentioned, so that they must have considered the act to have been harsh, but not wrong. We must then accordingly keep our eyes alert for even the smallest indication which may make all this psychologically explainable. So, and then he goes into his and the Smyrna's interpretation that the idea was that, like we said, you know, it was a question about the destiny and the future of Klal Yisrael. But the main lesson to learn from here, how difficult it is to be objective and how subjectivity, that's why we find when it comes to judgment and so on, shochad, or any kind of a favoritism or any kind of so-called bribery, is considered to disqualify a person from being able to give a proper judgment. Now, two brothers are shown here. The idea of Reuven. Reuven sought to save him. Lei nakenu nefesh. And in a sense, Reuven did bring about his safety for a while. And our Chazal tell us if Reuven, if he would have known the extent that the Torah looked at his deed, when in sentence 21 it says, Vayishma Reuven, Vayatileu miyodon, that Reuven heard about what they had planned, that they planned to kill him, and he saved him, miyodon, from their hands. If he would have known that this would be forever inscribed in the Torah, it says, Ilu Yoda Reuven. If Reuven would have known that thousands of years later, we would sit here in our Kola Avenue and we would read, Vayishma Reuven Vayatzileu Miyodon, that Reuven actually saved his brother, so he would have taken Yosef on his shoulders and he would have fought everybody off and he would have brought him back to the house. But the idea is that sometimes, and there's a sequel to that, and the Medrash continues, and it says, if Aaron would have known that it said in the Torah that when Moshe came from Midian to liberate the Jews with his family, so it says that Aaron will go out to greet you, and he will see you, and he will rejoice. And that's how it says in Chumash. So it says, if Aaron would have realized that, he would have brought along a 20-piece orchestra, the Stufim of the Mecholos. So what is the extent here that a lot of times we do something and it's good and it's a great deed, but we really don't realize the total ramifications of that. And therefore, perhaps not realizing, so you say, so what if you don't realize it? But not realizing it, we don't really do it with the entire effort or in totality as if we would if we realize the extent that this can determine our future. Because when you think back to it, Vayishma Reuven Yatzlem Yodam, from the life of Reuven, there are many things, a number of things are mentioned about Reuven, but this phrase which attributes the salvation and the safety and the saving of Reuven's life is mentioned specifically. Now, Ela told us Yaakov, these are the descendants of Yaakov. Yosef was 17 years old, Ben Shva Esrei Shona. He makes a note here that it's like saying Yosef was the son of 17 years old. Why does it say Ben Shva Esrei? It should say Yosef was Shva Esrei Shona, was 17 years. What is the interpretation of Ben? So he says because for better or for worse, the years are like mothers and educators which form us. The person is formed by the years of his experience. So what the mother brings him into the world, and educates him in a sense, but the experiences of the day also educate and form him. In fact, we find the din that you stand up for an older person because that is also a form, the Gemara says, of education, because in the years that have passed, there were events that occurred that educated him. So therefore, he is a person like a Ben Shavayas Rishona, just like a Talmud Chochem. He has the experience and the knowledge of learning the Torah. He's a son of Torah, a Ben Torah. So there's an idea also of a Ben experience, a Ben Shavayas Rishona. And this is the expression here, it says, of the Ben of 17 years. Now, Hoyereya Sachem B'tzein, it says his job was to be out as a shepherd with his brothers. Now, some say that he was, some commentaries, and it's a difficult concept why Yaakov would expect that or would distinguish him in the sense that he was Roya es Echav Batsein. He was like the spiritual leader of the brothers. Seems that Yosef had within him a certain koach, a certain power of leadership in a spiritual sense, and while the brothers were involved in the tzayin, he would overlook them spiritually. Now, if this was an appointment by the father, this already is asking for trouble, one would think, when you take the youngest one to, but the result really was, either if you learn that way or you take it in its simple form, that he was a fellow shepherd, as most learn, but he used this as an opportunity, instead of reprimanding or correcting them or admonishing them, he took all the tales and he went back to the father. Now he was as Ephraim Batsein, so he was with them in their daily life when they were in the assembly line. And a shepherd probably who is involved out in the field, so there are many things that he may do when he's not on his best conduct. And the Medrash depicts certain claims, we may mention later, that he came back against the brothers, that some claims were about their morality, supposedly he misunderstood, and misconstrued, because he was too young, and he jumped at conclusions. Hirsch says, he pictures him as a motherless child who's looking for affection, meaning that during the day, he was with the, there were two tiers, for better or for worse, the sons of Leah lorded it over the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. And this was one of the complaints that Yosef told the father, that they called the others Bnei Hashvachos, inferior members of Klal Yisrael. So he felt for them, he had compassion for them. So here says that his days were taken up with the elder brothers in the fields. But who did he associate with outside of this? He associated with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah and the Sheoviv, who were the wives of his fathers. Meaning that he went with the younger brethren. Now this would seem to imply that they didn't have anything against him. They were friends with him. If we say that Hunar, so Hirsch says that his stepbrothers, he didn't feel entirely at home, and he was drawn towards the sons of the Shvachos, to whom his vanity took him. Now, the only question that comes up is, why were the sons of the Shvachos, if he preferred to be with them, did they like him or not? Why didn't they stand up for him? Because if they would have been on his side, then they couldn't have sold him. We know Reuven, and I mean, he had four or five, he would have had the majority. With Reuven, who had six, there was no way that he would be able to have been sold. Now, the brothers, there's some interesting little observations that are made concerning the relationship of the brothers. For example, it says, Vayiru Echov. It says, sentence three, it says, V'Yisrael Ohavis Yosef Mikol Bonov Kiben Zekunim Ulo. He loved him more than all his children because he was a son of his old age, and he made him an embroidered cloak. Now, Vayiruach of the brothers saw that the father loved him, right? And therefore, they, the Yisnu also, V'le Yochlu Dabru L'Sholom,
They couldn't speak in him l'shalom. Now, from here, the Gra emphasizes the word bishalom or l'shalom. It says that the word l'shalom you should always say, because that's a good omen. Towards bishalom means you've come to the end. Chmon Litzlan, at a niftur, you always say lech bishalom, you finished your period in this world. The fact that it says v'leyochlu dabru l'shalom, the Gra points out, they couldn't speak l'shalom, meaning that they really finished, hoped that he had been finished here. Now, it says that the brothers, then one does the first idea that the brothers did not, it doesn't say yet, it says they despised him. Why? Because Yaakov Avinu loved him more than Mikol Echor from all the brothers. Now, they realized that, so some commentators point out, I think the Meshech Chochma, they realized that Yaakov had this stronger love for Rachel. That was self-evident. Everybody knew that. So therefore, that would be understandable that if he loves Rachel, he would still have a closeness to Rachel's children. So why did they pick on Yosef? So he points out, because it says, Oso avavia mikol echov, how about Binyamin? Binyamin was really the youngest one. Binyamin was there. So you would think that Binyamin should be the one, at least to be equal to Yosef, to be favored. Yet he showed favoritism to Yosef rather than to Binyamin. So they couldn't have attributed to the relationship that Yaakov had with Rachel, because then why did he overlook him?
It says they sold Yosef to Mitzrayim. Now this, it causes a lot of confusion in the way the sentences are written. If you notice, in sentence 25, Vayeshvu lechol lechem, they sat down to eat bread, they threw him into the pit. You know, they threw him into the pit. They first took off his garment, the Xenas Hapasi Masher Olof. They took off Yosef's coat. It's interesting, just there's no connection, but there are two places in this Sedra where it says that Yosef's coat was taken off of him. And in both places, really, he was innocent. Here, the brothers took off the coat, and later, Ashes Potiphar grabbed the coat off of Yosef as he was trying to run away from her. In both cases you have a coat. Now, it could be they both allude to this coat of many colors that Yosef really wasn't guilty of, but his whole destiny somehow seemed to be controlled by the original coat that Yaakov Avinu gave him. And Chazal point that out, that because of this extra coat that he gave him, we mentioned, all these things could have happened. But they took the coat later off of him. They wanted to give it back to the father in their plan. And they saw Yishma'elim coming. Ugmalehem nosim nechoos, I'm in sentence 25. And the camels were carrying certain spices and they were going to take these down to Egypt. So the idea, Hirsch explains, Vayisu einehem vayiru. Vayisu doesn't mean a casual looking around. Vayisu, he says, is an intentional one. And he learns when they sat down to eat, not like we had given the other interpretation, but when they sat down to eat and Yosef was in that pit, they still were uneasy and they couldn't really eat. They didn't come to the conclusion that they're going to yet leave him in the pit, and they were just looking around. And they were looking, but they were looking for another eight. Here they have him in the pit, and indeed his life is in danger, and it seems that their consciousness was still gnawing at them collectively. And like he says, it's an intentional looking. Let's look here, see, maybe there's another option. And then they saw the Yishma'elim coming about. Now the Yishma'elim would be, the way Hirsch says, they sold him to the Yishma'elim, and they could expect that he would remain with them. And after they sold the spices in Egypt, the Yishma'elim would go back to Arabia, and Yosef would be with them in Arabia. So he says that explains why later on, when the brothers came down to Egypt, according to some Midrashim, they expected to find Yosef there. They dispersed to go in all different ways to find Yosef. But in its simple interpretation, they didn't believe that Yosef would be in Egypt. Why? Because they thought he was someplace far off in Arabia. But what happened? He says this would still be more confirmed if, as possible, the brothers sold him to the Yishmaelites. and they would expect and be taken back to Arabia. But between that, the Midianites merchants passed by, who bought him from the Ishmaelites as a speculation, and they sold him in Egypt. Now, what does he get the Midianites? Because if you notice, sentence 25 says they sat down to eat bread. They were looking, like we're saying, for another option. They saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilad, going towards the direction of Egypt. So Yehuda says in sentence 26, "Ma betza, what do we gain? Kinaharig es ochinu, if we kill our brother, v'chisinu es dome, and we cover the blood." So Beis Halevi has an interesting interpretation. He says normally, when someone commits a terrible offense, there are two reasons why you would kill him. One is because you hate the person, you have vengeance against him. And the other reason would be because you want it to be a lesson that other people shouldn't become plotters, shouldn't commit the same crime. He said, in this instance, he says, what are we going to gain? We'll find no satisfaction if we kill our brother. There won't be any satisfaction because it's our brother. In fact, our conscience will always trouble us. That's what they really said later. You'll say, but this will be a deterrent to anybody in the future to do such acts. But no, v'chisinu es dome. We're not going to be able to openly publicize it. We're going to go ahead and have to hide it. So therefore, he says, ma betza, what is there for us to gain? Ki nahareg es ochinu v'chisinu es dome. If we kill him, it's still our brother. And although we think we're right, he says, because we have to, otherwise he'll capture the Klal Yisrael. We think we're right, but we're still going to have conscience pangs that it is our brother. Secondly, you'll say, but this will forever be a lesson, but nobody will know about it because v'chisinu es dome. So what are we going to accomplish? This sentence is, from the Bible critics who speak of the terrible character of our fathers. So he says, "Ma betza ki nahareg es ochinu," meaning what money could we make? And this, the Seinei Yisrael, the enemies of Klal Yisrael, have forever used this case as an example of the money, the lust that Jews have for the money grubbers. In fact, the slichas that we say in Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av also, when he speaks of the Asura Arugei Malchus, so we say that they were taken and they were brought to such a terrible death because they supposedly had to bring about forgiveness for the money grubbers that their fathers were, that they sold their own brother. And Christianity always likes to picture that also, as you have the Jewish people in the time of the temple. They were the money changers and money lenders and so on. They had no morality, and then Christianity came along with its morality, and they therefore sold him. And again, the Jew is the Shylock, and they sold him, and terrible, terrible things. That's the Mabetza. This Pasuk is always quoted, Mabetza kinare gochino. But we interpret Mabetza as not in the sense of monetary gain, but Mabetza, we have to do this, but what do we gain by doing it? Now to say, after everything is there, you still have to have a strong-necked people to go ahead and to make these determinations. Well, that is true. Hirsch wants to say that, and the truth is that that's why we had to go down to Mitzrayim. And the way he says the ideal, I mean, if that nation whose proclivity was az shebi'umos, no means the most pliant of people, that's Klal Yisrael, in whose natural tendencies no came venoter could very well lie. That means no came venoter to take vengeance. And in the early days of which we see even crimes, these things came out of Kina and Sina. So he says, if that nation became so elevated by the education it received, by its faith and teachings, that crimes like Shvichas Domi, like murder, and immorality were unknown amongst them centuries later, if it became the most humane, the most neighbor-loving nation, if Providence could risk throwing it into the arms of being mishandled by laws, which throughout centuries were calculated He says, to sow the strongest divisions, the most hopeless kina and sina, Jew laws, which could make children long for the death of the fathers, younger brothers for that of the older ones. There were laws that only one person in the family could be married, could have a business, could have a household. There were all kind of laws. Yet, we find that the natural bond, if nevertheless the Jewish family life, with its children and family love, can emerge from such terrible tests, if the Jewish Azus can be transfigured, he says, into rock-like firmness against all the temptations, it is a triumph for the Torah, for the divine law, which did not come from us, but to us. And this he emphasizes a number of places in Chumash, and this is one instance which is so true, because he was trying to show you that the kina and sina among the brothers and so on brought to such a terrible thing. Historically, that means we had that potential, Ashabilmas. Historically, later on, though, the Jews were very family-centered, and all of these crimes that supposedly are based on emotions of Nekima and Netira, these crimes were totally missing. Now, if this was our proclivity towards that, if this was our natural tendency, how did this happen? So he says it was only the Torah that was able to make this Ashabiumos. The Torah was able to temper that spirit and bring in this certain humane, ethical behavior into Klal Yisrael. And he emphasizes the idea where murder and Shrichas Domin and Bilal Arayas were not rampant, and we know how true that is. The effects of thousands of years of Torah. The fact that we see it now is because the Torah in one generation. I mean, even the secular parties in Israel, again, referring to Israel, even the secular parties bemoan the direction that the youth from their secular studies and education have taken. It's the traditional people in Israel that have still adhered to this high morality. But those that have gone in the kibbutzim, you read the terrible things that happen, socialist kibbutzim and so on, in the form of immorality and lack of concern for each other, the crime is there. So it's only the limud of Torah that, and when you find a generation that doesn't have the Torah, you see it. And what do you need more when you place one generation against the same generation who has the Torah, who studied the Torah? And you see really the difference from day to night. So there's no question that this can change. I mean, we see the children in the Orthodox community. I mean, the difference from them, there are exceptions, but the normal cases, you don't have all of the problems and the delinquency that you have among people that are totally divorced from them. Of course, there are exceptions, but you see that the Torah is able to fashion, to pattern, to subdue these inclinations in man. So that's what he points out. Now, who took him out of the well? This is just not that it's important, but it's interesting. Verse says in 25, we see the Yishmaelim were going to do it. In 28, it says that Anoshim Midyonim, Socharim, Midianites passed by, and they took Yosef out of the well, and they sold him to the Yishmaelim. So now, the Midianites took him out of the well and sold him to the Yishmaelim. The brothers, it seemed, did not end up taking him out of the well at all. They were just contemplating doing it. They saw Yishmaelim there. So as they were contemplating, let's sell him to the Yishmaelim, the Midianites went ahead and they took him out of the well and they sold him to the Yishmaelim. That's how it says clearly in sentence 28. Yet if we'll look a little bit further in sentence 36, it says there, the Midonim Mochru Oso El Mitzrayim. The Midonim, and the Midonim is the Midyonim. We know that Midonim and Midyon are the same. They sold them to Egypt. Now here it seems that the Yishmaelim bought them from Midyon, and now we say the Midianites sold them to Egypt. So they Rashi bring down the Medrash, he was sold many times. He was bartered back and forth. Yet if you look at chapter 39, sentence 1. There it says, that Yosef was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar Saris Paro bought him Miyad HaYishmaelim. So here again it seems not the Midianim, but the Yishmaelim. So it's easy to say, like some say, that he was bartered back and forth. Yet, Hirsch says a different interpretation, that actually, that the brothers did not sell Yosef. They wanted to sell him. The Midianites came by in the meantime and took him and sold him to the Yishmaelim. The Midianites picked him up and sold him to the Yishmaelim. Let me just find here. The brothers wanted to sell him to the Ishmaelites. The brothers always believed that. Meanwhile, the merchants came along, the Midianim. They fetched Yosef up and they sold him to the Ishmaelites. The brothers believed that he was in their hands and had gone back to their homeland. They had no idea that the Ishmaelites had nevertheless sold him into Egypt. Now, in any case, the brothers had the responsibility for the sale, because they wanted to do it, it was in their mind, and they gladly allowed it to proceed without hindering it in any way, which they could easily have done. The Ramban wants to learn that really they were the caravan, and the riders were Yishmaelites. But the Midyanim Socharim, they were the ones who hired the caravan and the riders. So therefore the owners of the train wagon, or the wagon train, happened to be Midyanim. But the riders and so on, they were Yishmaelites. The brothers originally saw the Yishmaelites coming, so they thought, we'll sell it to him, sell it to the Yishmaelites. But at the end, it turned out that it was a Midyanim, but the caravan were Yishmaelites who were working for the Midyanim. This is the alternative shot that the Ramban goes through.